So, as you'll see here, that the title today is Financial Stability in Uncertain Times. And I want to thank you actually for inviting me here to talk to you about this subject. I obviously would much have preferred to be with you as we were discussing, but the fact I can't be in the same room actually highlights the really unusual times we're living in and which has created so much uncertainty for us all. And actually, the timing of this speech is quite fortuitous because we released our 6-monthly financial stability review at the beginning of October. So today, what I plan to do is give you a quick tour of the key messages. The headline is that the financial system is strong and in a good position to support the economy through these difficult times. But there are some risks. Some of them are emanating from overseas, and others are closer to home in the balance sheets of households and businesses. The Reserve Bank of Australia and the Council of Financial Regulators will be closely monitoring these risks over the coming months. So that what I plan to do today is talk a little bit about what we mean by financial stability and why it's important. And then I'll touch on how we monitor financial stability, and I'll pull out some of the highlights of the financial stability review. So first of all, what is financial stability? Financial stability is a state of the world that might seem easy to define, but it's actually quite hard to measure. So on our website, we say the following. We say a stable financial system is one in which financial institutions, markets, and market infrastructures facilitate the smooth flow of funds between savers and investors. This helps to promote growth in economic activity. So financial stability is really when the financial system is doing its job. That's why, and I've said this in a number of other places, it's actually financial instability that is easier to explain and picture. So this is where the financial sector is experiencing disruptions, so it harms the economy. And the consequences are very obvious. So the global financial crisis a decade ago was a very vivid demonstration of what can happen when the financial system is unstable. Credit supply dries up, investment and consumption fall, and unemployment rises. So there's a very obvious human cost. Financial stability is a key responsibility of all central banks, but the way they give effect to that responsibility depends very much on the regulatory model. So in Australia's case, the banking system is at the core of our financial system, but it's supervised and regulated by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, who you may have heard of. The Reserve Bank, however, has an important role in monitoring the financial system as a whole and identifying and communicating vulnerabilities. It also chairs the Council of Financial Regulators, through which the main financial sector regulators, which are APRA, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, and the Australian Treasury, we group together to coordinate to promote the stability of the financial system. And the other thing the Reserve Bank does is it provides liquidity to institutions and markets, something that was actually very important in the GFC, as well as in the early stage of the pandemic. Now, one important output from the Reserve Bank in fulfilling its responsibility for financial stability is this document called the Financial Stability Review. I'll call it the reviews as I'm talking. Now, the review is published every 6 months in April and October, and it provides a very comprehensive picture of the state of financial stability. The latest review was released 3 weeks ago. So now I'm going to provide you a bit of an overview about how we monitor financial stability, and then I'm going to turn to some key messages from the latest review. So as I've said, in a stable financial system, financial institutions and markets are in a position to ensure that households and businesses get access to finance in order to keep the wheels of the economy turning. This clearly involves the banking system, but it also involves financial markets more broadly, such as equity markets, debt markets, and non-bank financial institutions that also operate in these markets and facilitate these markets. And it's also not just about Australian financial institutions and markets that matter for financial stability. Financial institutions and markets operate across borders. So, as we saw in the GFC in 2008, instability in one country can have spillover effects on other countries. And an important part of analysing financial stability is therefore understanding how resilient all these various components of the international and domestic financial system are to shocks to their balance sheets and their operations. The other part of monitoring financial stability is scanning for where the financial system might be vulnerable if circumstances were to change. So in the global financial crisis, for example, the initial crucial vulnerability was weak lending standards on home loans in the United States, which left borrowers and lenders there very vulnerable to falling house prices. But as loans that were typically packaged up and sold off, there was a great deal of uncertainty about who actually was exposed to this debt. So when housing prices started to fall and a large number of households couldn't meet their debts, this uncertainty resulted in banks being reluctant to lend to one another and to customers and cascading problems. And ultimately, the financial system couldn't meet its task of funding the economy, and the result was a recession in many countries. So although we're not able to predict exactly where a shock will come from, if we have an understanding of the resilience of the financial system and then the areas it might be vulnerable to a change in circumstances, we can form a view about the risk to financial stability. And the current circumstance is an interesting case in point. I don't think anyone would have predicted at the end of last year that in 2020 there'd be a massive shock to the global economy from a global pandemic. But what we did know was that the banking system was much stronger than it was 10 years ago, prior to the global financial crisis. And we also knew where some of the vulnerabilities lay. So this has allowed us to form some views on the current state of financial stability. So I'm going to turn to that now. So how stable is the Australian financial system? Well, in the review, we typically set the scene for this by discussing developments in the international financial system and vulnerabilities in other countries. This is because, as I've already noted, instability in one country can spill over into others. But in the interest of time today, I'm not going to spend time on the international context because I want to focus on the Australian financial system and vulnerabilities. So I'll just make two brief points about the international circumstances. Firstly, banks internationally are in a much stronger position than they were prior to the global financial crisis. Regulatory reforms over the past decade have ensured that banks have increased the amount of capital and liquidity they hold, and this has enabled them to continue to lend even as the economic outcomes have worsened this time around. They've been able to support the economy rather than winding back their lending and amplifying the crisis. Second, there are some pre-existing international vulnerabilities. High corporate debt in some countries, high sovereign debt in Europe, and low profitability of banks in some countries, all these things pose a risk to financial stability. In the current recession, this is likely to exacerbate these issues and potentially impact the financial system's ability to cushion the shock. In terms of the Australian financial system, our judgment is that it is strong and able to support the economic recovery from the COVID-19 induced recession. So I'll just turn to the first graph. So Australian banks were in a very strong position coming into this recession. This graph here shows the capital ratios of the largest banks in Australia. Now, what these ratios measure is the amount of equity on the bank's balance sheet as a share of what we call risk-weighted assets. So they're just exposures weighted by how risky they are. And they provide a measure of the ability of banks to absorb losses. The four major banks that account for about 75% of banking system assets in Australia, they have capital ratios of at least 10.5%, well in excess of their regulatory requirement, what they have to hold, of 8%. The other large banks, so it's many large regional banks, also have capital ratios well in excess of their regulatory minimums. This capital and their regulatory buffers can be used to absorb losses, and that'll provide banks with space to continue lending to support the economic recovery. And indeed, APRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority, has encouraged banks to use their capital buffers just for this purpose. Now, the fact that the Australian banking system is so well capitalised is the result of a multi-year program by the Prudential Regulation Authority to increase the capital levels of the Australian banks. While the Australian banks did not experience the issues of many overseas banks during the global financial crisis, APRA has nevertheless implemented the key international regulatory reforms designed to strengthen the banking system following the GFC, and it's also retained some rules where Australia's system is more conservative than the global standard. So they've been even tougher in a sense. The aggregate capital ratio of the banks is nearly double what it was prior to the global financial crisis. And the capital ratios of the major banks are estimated to be well within the top quartile of global banks, so within the top 25%. And they're at a level that would be sufficient to withstand really severe shocks. Now, another aspect of the Australian bank's strength is their profitability. So prior to the current crisis, Australian banks were some of the most profitable among the advanced economies. On average, over the 5 years to 2019, the return on equity for the Australian banks was around 12%, and you can see that in this graph. In the face of the economic recession brought on by the current health crisis, banks have sharply increased their reserves for future losses over the first half of 2020, and as a result, their profits have halved relative to the second half of 2019, and you can see that on this chart in the blue line turning down quite sharply. But they still remain profitable. There is going to be further pressure on banks' profits and capital over the coming year, but with substantial uncertainty about the economic outcomes, it's difficult to determine how large the impact might be. So one way of getting a feel for the possible outcomes is to use a model to estimate how far banks' capital ratios would fall under different economic scenarios. So we reported on the results of this exercise in the recent Financial Stability Review. We considered two scenarios that were based on those in the Reserve Bank's other major publication, the Statement on Monetary Policy. There was a baseline scenario, and then there was a downside scenario, so a more negative scenario. And what this shows you in this graph here, on the far left, that's the current. And then the baseline shows you what would happen to their capital ratios in the baseline scenario. And that shows it declines to a bit under 10%. And then in the downside scenario, which is the next bar, you'll see it declines to a bit over 9%. And with a sort of a minimum of 8%, which is sort of a regulatory minimum plus buffers, that's in fact meaning that they remain, the banks still have capital ratios well in excess of their prudential minimums. So that's very positive. There's another exercise we can undertake using this model, which we also report on in the Financial Stability Review. And that is to ask the question, how bad would economic outcomes have to be for the banks to see their capital ratios fall well into their regulatory capital buffers? Now, this is a really uncertain exercise because we're considering scenarios that are so far away from past experience that it's a bit difficult to judge. Such scenarios are much worse than anything that's currently envisaged in Australia. But just as an example for you, one scenario that would see a major bank's capital ratio fall below 6%, so that's that red bar in the right there, that is well into its capital conservation buffer, a scenario would be a fall in property prices of about 50%, GDP declining by 20%, and unemployment rising to 20%. Now, a downturn of this magnitude has not been observed since the Great Depression. And even then, even in this circumstance, the capital ratios remain about the prudential minimums. So what this confirms really is that it seems pretty unlikely that a major bank would fail. So that's all about the resilience of the banks, but what about the vulnerabilities? So the banks are starting from a good position, a lot of capital, strong profits, but as I alluded to earlier, the economic effects of containing the health crisis are going to put pressure on their profits and their balance sheets. And the main way this is going to happen is through credit losses, both through business and household loans. Now, the large contraction in economic activity as a result of the house crisis, the health crisis, has had a substantial impact on many businesses and households, as you will all be aware. While a range of income support policies and actions by lenders and landlords have so far provided support, some of these measures will soon come to an end, and there's uncertainty about others. So with a very uncertain economic recovery, this raises issues about the resilience of households and businesses, and ultimately about the credit quality of banks' assets. Many businesses, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, have experienced huge disruptions, either through enforced lockdowns or consumers choosing to restrict their movements and their purchases. Small businesses have been particularly hard hit, with revenue falling in aggregate by close to 15% since March, and many have seen it fall much further than that. In industries such as arts and recreation, for example, accommodation and food services, the declines in sales have been much, much bigger. Having said that, direct government subsidies and reductions in expenses, including through such things as loan deferrals and rent moratoriums, have increased cash flow, and as a result, business cash buffers have in fact increased. So you can see from this graph, the green bars are prior to the pandemic and the purple bars are post-pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, about half of businesses only had enough cash on hand to pay 1 month's expenses, and around a quarter had enough cash to cover more than 3 months of expenses. So by October, more than 60% of businesses had enough cash on hand to cover three or more months of expenses. So this is going to be very helpful during the recovery. Furthermore, the vast majority of companies went into the pandemic and resulting recession reasonably well placed in terms of debt and their ability to service it. So debt to equity ratios, which is the right-hand panel of this graph, they're generally lower than they were a decade ago. And earnings for most companies easily cover their interest payments, which is the left-hand side of the graph, which is interest to expenses. Even so, interest coverage ratios have been falling for a number of years, as you can see. And despite policy support, some businesses are facing very challenging circumstances. This raises questions about their capacity to service their debt once the various measures of assistance are wound back. Business failures will increase as the economy starts to recover. The pace of the recovery will clearly be very important, as will the extent and timing of the unwinding of the various support measures. Business failures are currently actually much lower than usual because of income support, loan repayment deferrals, and also temporary insolvency relief. And you can see in this graph that for 2020, which is the dark line, the business failures by month are lower than they've been on average over the previous 5 years. But this actually can't last, and we expect failures rise. So survey evidence suggests that around a quarter of small businesses that are currently receiving income support would close if support was removed now and trading conditions had not improved. While not all business failures will result in losses for the banks, it will have an impact on banks' balance sheets. One area that's of particular concern for us is commercial property. The retail sector was already dealing with long-run structural change prior to the pandemic, with retail vacancies on the rise. And this has accelerated with the onset of the pandemic, particularly in CBD retail, as you can see in this graph. Similarly, there's uncertainty about prospects for rental demand for CBD office property, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. In both of these cities, there's substantial new supply coming onto the market, and vacancy rates have already started to rise. Commercial property prices could experience sharp falls in this environment, putting pressure on investors that had borrowed to invest in such property. While banks don't have a large direct exposure to commercial property, impairment rates are likely to rise. So that's about businesses, but households have also been impacted by the pandemic-induced recession. Prior to the onset of the pandemic, household debt in Australia was already at a high level. Provided households have the income to support servicing this debt, this is not a problem. But the onset of the pandemic-induced recession raises the possibility that some households will be unable to meet their repayments because their incomes have fallen, and so banks will experience an increase in non-performing loans. Some households have experienced significant falls in labour income due to job losses, reduced working hours, and lower wages. For those affected, however, cash flow has been underpinned by government income support policies, loan repayment deferrals from the banks, and low interest rates. In addition, there's been around 4.5 million approved requests for the early release of superannuation, in totaling around about $34 billion, and that's around about 10% of household income. Combined with falls in consumption, this has resulted in a substantial rise in saving by households, and they've used this saving to pay down debt or build deposits. This has been the case for renters, owner-occupiers, and outright homeowners, as shown on this graph. There is one point to note here, though, that this is the aggregate story, and one thing we do know is that the distribution of saving and debt matters. So, although this is the aggregate, not all households will have been able to increase saving, and some will find themselves in difficult circumstances. So these savings buffers, along with continued support from fiscal measures, will provide enough support to most households to resume repayments on their loans. At the peak in June, around 8% of housing loans were on deferred payments. Many of these deferrals ended in September and October, and payments have recommenced. There's still, however, a significant minority of households that are seeking to remain on deferred repayments. Many of these loans are higher risk in that they tend to have higher loan-to-valuation ratios, or they're held by people who work in industries particularly at risk from the current health crisis, as shown in this graph, which shows you the deferral rates for high LVR loans and high-risk industries. Non-performing loans to households, which had already risen over the past couple of years, are therefore expected to rise over the coming months. The impact on bank balance sheets of the rise in non-performing loans is going to depend on whether the value of the property is enough to cover the outstanding debt. That is, whether the household is in negative equity, the borrower is in negative equity. If the loan's in positive equity, then the borrower has the option of resolving the situation by selling the property and repaying the debt. Now, there's only a very small share of loans that are currently in negative equity, which suggests that losses to banks on housing loans will probably be limited. If, however, there is a substantial fall in housing prices, that could change. Demand for housing and housing prices have so far held up pretty well. Most of the demand is coming from owner-occupiers, supported by low interest rates and government grants for new housing. But with population growth forecast to remain weak for the next year or so and an uncertain economic recovery, it is possible that conditions could weaken, at least in some cities. Price falls could be exacerbated by housing investors who, seeing vacancy rate rising and rents falling, decide to sell. So in conclusion, the COVID-19 pandemic has had a devastating impact on the world and the Australian economy. So far, the financial system, both here and overseas, has withstood the test. Banks were well capitalised going into the crisis and are able to use their substantial buffers to support the economy. The Australian financial system in particular remains profitable, notwithstanding substantial loan loss provisions. Their strong capital position allows them to continue to lend to support the Australian economy. Nevertheless, the economic recovery is expected to be unpredictable and uneven. So there's going to be rising business insolvencies and problems for some households in servicing their debts. So these are all going to be areas to watch as we monitor financial stability over the next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. Now, do we have any questions from anybody that we would like to ask, Michelle?
Michelle, do you think interest rates will rise anytime soon?
I think I can quote the governor numerous times in saying no, no time soon. I think that's his standard answer, and I think you've put it very well.
Thank you. What about the financial markets? Do you have any?
Yeah, so the financial markets, you might recall that back in March, there was a lot of disruption in the financial markets early on because it was very uncertain. They didn't know what they were expecting. Everyone was basically dashing for cash, and that had caused problems, liquidity problems in the markets. The central banks around the world basically came in to provide liquidity and make sure that the markets could function, because if the markets aren't functioning, then it's very difficult then for the credit markets to function as well. If the equity markets aren't functioning, the debt markets aren't functioning, then that's going to mean that the credit, which basically greases the wheels of the economy, just seizes up. So there's still some jitters about that, but I think the central banks showed such determination to make sure that that liquidity remained in the system and the markets could continue to function, that I think people are reasonably confident that that they will continue to do that. Having said that, that doesn't mean that there mightn't be periods of volatility in financial markets. I think it's possible there will be. We've seen a little bit of that in equity markets in recent days.
Will the withdrawal of from the people's superannuation have much effect?
It's actually only a small percentage of funds under management, Linda. I think there's a bit of a discussion about whether or not what it might mean for people at the retirement age. That's a separate discussion. But in terms of the actual funds under management, it's actually only a small percentage of funds, so it's not going to impact the superannuation funds themselves. And, you know, it has been very helpful to some people who really needed some money in a hurry. So you can weigh up the long-term impact of that, I guess, against what people thought was a short-term need for them in this pandemic. So I think, and the superannuation funds themselves remain solid.
Michelle, it's Michael Heath from Bloomberg. There's a lot of talk, obviously, about bond buying programs and things, but no one really talks about the potential impact of that on financial stability. I mean, is the issue just that, you know, the immediate need is greater than that, or is that something you factor in there as well?
I think, Michael, in the current circumstances, so financial stability in the past, where things are quite normal, is very different than it is currently, where we've got no prospect of inflation for the next few years. Interest rates are remaining low for the next few years. So I think this is a very different circumstance. And when you look at balancing the relativities between the risks, the risks are very different this time around. What we're doing now is we've got a situation, we've got resilient banks, we've got some vulnerabilities which will be exacerbated by the economy, and the main thing is to get the economy trying to move.
Do you think the bank lending criteria will ease up or tighten up as we move out of the process of the pandemic, sort of, which can be, you know, crippling small business expanding moving forward while there's the availability of the low rates that are out there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Finance in normal times for small businesses is not necessarily easy. So a couple of things there. I think it is anecdotally, we're hearing a little bit from liaison that banks are willing to finance existing small business customers, but they're a little bit leery about taking on new ones because they don't know as much about them, perhaps. But a couple of points that are positive, I think. One is that the Small Business Growth Fund, the government has got that off the ground now. So that's the idea is a little bit of equity investment in small business, which might help. I think the banks do have the ability to continue to fund small business. So they can't use the excuse that they don't have capital to do that. So we will be continuing to encourage them to do that. And at the margin, it might be that the removal of the responsible lending obligations in their current form might ease things up a little as well, because we were hearing reports that there was a little bit of confusion about how you treat small businesses. Do you have to treat them according to responsible lending obligations? The answer was no, but I think banks were a little bit confused about how they dealt with that, particularly where small business finances and household finances might have been quite interlinked. So that might help a little bit at the margin as well. So I think what you'll see is that it might get a little bit more difficult, but the banks are going to be getting lots of encouragement to continue lending to small businesses.
Michelle, will interest rates drop?
Sorry?
Can they go any lower?
What
is the chance of them going lower?
So I'm not going to answer that, Linda. What I'm going to say is that my bosses, in particular Guy DeBell, the Deputy Governor, gave a talk the other day in which he set out a number of options, a number of things that could be done, one of which was possible further lowering of interest rates. He didn't give one way or the other, but he did give some ideas about what might be done in addition. And one of those options was, in fact, a bit further of a fall in interest rates. I recommend his speech to you.
Okay.
Sure, one last one, sorry. Just on Victoria, in your speech you mentioned that I think it was about a quarter of businesses that are on JobSeeker and might not be viable without support. Do you have any numbers on Victoria on what the situation is there, or is it too early? You have to wait until the economy opens up?
No, the information we're quoting, so the ABS, the Bureau of Statistics, has been doing sort of little ad hoc surveys, and one of the surveys they did was businesses. And 25% of businesses that are currently receiving support said if they remove the support now and the economy wasn't moving again, then they would fail. So it's quite a specific circumstance. We don't have any specific regional breakdown on that. All we have is just because it's not a very big sample, but it's that's all we've got.
So nothing from Liaison, though?
Nothing as specific as that from Liaison. But you know, obviously. The longer it goes on, the more the small businesses, the income support, what we can say, I think, from the information we've got is that the income support coming from the government for small businesses has been crucial in keeping their cash flow going, keeping their cash buffers up. So if that support gets removed and the economy isn't moving, then you would expect to see an increase in business failures.
Has anyone got any other questions?
I think from what I can gather, we are in a pretty strong position here in Australia. So it's like it shouldn't take that long for us to recover. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not in the business of forecasting, and in fact, I think towards the end of next week, I think it is that the bank will release some more forecasts. But I think the words that people tend to use are uneven, uncertain, and it's probably going to be a bumpy ride, even in Australia. You know, I think there are certain signs that things are recovering, but it's going to be a bumpy ride, I think.